Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. So glad you could join us today. Many of us like to go out to restaurants and to spend time with our friends and family members and to enjoy some of our favorite foods cooked by people who really know what they're doing. I think that's why we've seen the popularity of competitive cooking shows on television really explode. Well, this morning, you're in for a treat. I'm talking with one of those talented and charismatic chefs you may have seen on TV shows like Top Chef and Iron Chef. He's a Minnesotan and the owner or operator of several restaurants here in the Twin Cities, like Handsome Hog, The Gnome, and Noise and Cutler on the Park. During the pandemic, we saw him doing what he could do to help out community members in need of free food and laid off hospitality workers in need of income. I'm talking about Chef Justin Sutherland. Justin has lots to talk about this morning, including how he is recovering from a serious boating accident back in July. And as I talk with Justin, I want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open. You can call us and you know, I want to know, have you eaten at any of his restaurants? If so, what are your favorite foods there? And do you have a question about what it's like behind the scenes of those TV cooking competitions? Or do you need some recipe advice? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can also leave me a message on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. Good morning, Justin. I am so happy to see you.
Good morning, Angela. Thanks for having me.
Hi. I know chefs typically aren't early morning people, so I'm glad you're here with me at 9 in the morning.
I appreciate it.
Well, the last time I saw you in person was in June. I was sitting at an outdoor table at Handsome Hog in St. Paul, having chicken wings and bourbon with NPR host Tom Cran. And I said to you, I was like, hey, I want you to come on the show. And you said, certainly, I have a cookbook coming out in September. So here we are.
Absolutely. It is now September. That book is out.
The book is out and I'm holding it. The cookbook is titled Northern Soul, Southern Inspired Home Cooking from a Northern Kitchen. Why did you want to write a cookbook?
You know, it's just one of those things that felt right for the time. I mean, you know, I've been owning and operating restaurants for 7 years, and especially the restaurants and, or the recipes in this book, a lot of the stuff is derived from stuff we do at Handsome Hog, and I'm constantly stopped asking, how do you make this? Can you email me this recipe, this and that? So I just felt like we should give the people what they wanted.
And you did. I mean, it's not just some of the popular foods. It's also spice blends and drink recipes as well.
Absolutely. I wanted this to be a very, very, you know, comfortable home cookbook. You know, you buy some of those cookbooks and you get it home and you're like, I could never make this. I don't even know where to get these ingredients. So this is just very basic and stuff that anybody should be able to execute.
In the introduction, you referenced your childhood and your love for bread as a toddler, as well as pots and pans and wooden spoons as toys. You write, at age 5, when most boys wanted a Tonka truck, I wanted an easy bake oven. What were you going to do with that easy bake oven, Justin?
I mean, I was going to bake brownies with a 100-watt light bulb like everybody else.
I did that.
Oh, absolutely.
And I love the photos in the book. There are a lot of family photos, which, you know, surprised me when I opened it up. And there's a lovely picture of your grandmother, Masako. Tell me about your grandma and the role that she played in your early exposure to cooking.
Yeah, I mean, my grandma took care of my brothers and I growing up. I mean, she was our everything, our babysitter every day. But she came over to this country during the Korean War from Japan. She spoke zero English when she came to the country, and with the relations that the U.S. and Japan had with each other at that time, she wasn't even allowed to teach her kids Japanese. They said, if you come here, you're an American, you have to disregard everything Japanese about yourself, so, and that terrified her. So really the only, her love language, the way she shared, you know, her family, her country, her heritage was through her food. And we were so blessed at a young age to be able to go and experience stuff that, you know, 5-6-year-olds weren't eating, sukiyaki and tonkatsu and sushi and all the stuff she used to make. So, I mean, food was a really a big connection with our grandmother.
And you talked about inviting your friends over to experience the magic that she was making in the kitchen.
Absolutely. I mean, we thought, we didn't realize that nobody else our age was eating like this, but it was just so good, and we couldn't believe when we'd talk about these foods to our friends that they'd never heard of it. So it was just always a joy to bring our friends over and have grandma cook for them.
You have two exceptional grandmothers. You talk about the Southern inspiration for your cooking. You write, on my father's side, I am the descendant of slaves and sharecroppers. My grandfather, Harold, came up from Mississippi and settled in Waterloo, Iowa, and my grandma, Zona. Food was Zona's love language, and her food was the start of my love of soul food and barbecue. Tell me about Grandma Zona.
Absolutely. She was just the rock of the family or the neighborhood in general. She was the big mama, the one always putting on the big Sunday suppers, inviting, you know, anybody over that needed to come eat. Every time we walked into her house, there's, you know, always a big pot of collard greens boiling on the stove, you know, pot of grease to fry chicken. There was just always food around. And, you know, they grew up fairly poor, not with a lot of money. So that was the way to, you know, to give back and connect. And again, like you said, food was just her love language.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about your grandfather. Your grandma Zona has passed away, but you also dedicate the cookbook to your grandpa Burrell. What is his story? What did you learn from him?
Yeah, Burrell's, that's actually my grandma Masako's husband. So he, you know, he met Masako in the Korean War when he was stationed over there, and she was the bartender in the GI bar. And when the war was over, he grabbed her and said, "You're coming with me." And, you know, so she brought him over here. But he grew up, you know, during the Great Depression, you know, farmers, carpenters, and very Midwest meat and potatoes. We ate with grandpa. It was always, you know, meatloaf and roast beef and just very hearty Minnesotan foods.
He was Scandinavian.
He was Scandinavian, yep, 100% Norwegian, and he'd tell you about it every second he could.
So I'm thinking about young Justin. So you have an Asian influence, an African-American influence, a Scandinavian influence. So all of this comes together today in the way you cook?
Absolutely. I think just having that worldview of food and being able to combine all of these different cultures has definitely influenced the way that I cook.
You were in the news a couple of years ago during the pandemic when your knife set was stolen from inside your car. Somebody smashed the window right in front of the your car. It was parked in front of Handsome Hog.
Yep.
And then days later, a little girl found it and returned to you. Why was it so devastating to lose that knife set? Why was it important?
Yeah, my grandma's brother was a chef in Tokyo, actually. And when he retired, closed his restaurants, he mailed a lot of his knives up to me, as well as a lot of knives that my grandmother had passed down. So, I mean, these were some 100-year-old Japanese steel knives. I mean, invaluable. You could never buy them again, and they wouldn't have that value to anybody else but me. So, I mean, that was one of the most devastating things that disappeared.
And then a child found them?
Yes, it was up on the in the Selby neighborhood. If you know, sometimes they hide these little fairy houses in the bushes that kids can go find. And she was just walking her dog with her mom, digging through bushes looking for fairy houses. And the knife was stashed in there. And it had my Handsome Hog business card on it. And they ran across the street and gave it to me. And just previously, they had heard the story in the news. Mm-hmm. So when they found it, they're like, oh my gosh. So, you know, I'm assuming somebody else heard that story, realized that these had no value to them because it was within a block of the restaurant. So, you know, whoever did that, I'm happy that you got the message, and thank that little girl near the bottom of my heart.
Where did you go to culinary school?
At Le Cordon Bleu in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose to go to culinary school? So as a child, you know, you like to cook.
Yep.
But then why make it a profession? What was going on when you were, I guess, like in your late teens?
You know, honestly, I always loved food, but it was never something I was going to do professionally. I went to MSU Mankato for business management, and I was going to start law school. And my whole life, I mean, I was going to be a lawyer no matter what. That was my plan. I remember selling mortgage after Mankato, getting ready for law school, and sitting in the office doing cold calls and research and all this stuff. And I remember calling my dad, and I was like, I don't think this office life is going to be for me. I was like, I can't do six more years of law school. And you know, so he was like, you know, you've always loved cooking. He's like, why don't you try culinary school? You've already got a business degree. You can always go back to law school, but you know, it's, you might as well figure out what you love now rather than going through all this and realizing later in life that wasn't for you. So pivoted, and you know, I wanted to go to Atlanta for two reasons. One, to miss some winters for the first time in my life, and I was really interested in soul food, and I really wanted to go, you know, to a city that that just, you know, exemplified mm-hmm. Black excellence, and just see really you know, successful African Americans doing their thing and get immersed in the Southern food culture.
Mm-hmm. I lived in Atlanta shortly after I graduated from college. My son lives there now while he is in college, and it is a very it's a very different vibe than the Twin Cities for sure. But I had my notes here that you actually, your course of study, you studied French cuisine while you were there in culinary school?
Yeah, I mean, Le Cordon Bleu is a classic French, you know, culinary school. So most of the practices are based around that.
Mm-hmm. And how does that come into play now as you cook and have all these other influences?
You know, I'm really glad I got that base. And luckily enough, one of my first, you know, real chef jobs was here in St. Paul at Meritage. That was the place I wanted to work forever. My application got denied for years. And one day, just because nobody really leaves there, I mean, most of the people who I worked there with are still there. So I finally got my job at Meritage and spent, you know, over 5 years working with Russell, working my way up to sous chef with him. So the French influence definitely shows in all of my food.
So a couple of things I'm already noticing. So you did a big pivot. You listened to yourself and said, like, this is not making me happy studying business, potentially going to law school. And so you had, what does it take to do that? Is it courage or just a feeling, an instinct, like, I wasn't meant to be on this course?
Yeah, I think it takes a lot. It takes that initial feeling, and then it takes, you know, listening to that feeling, because a lot of people would be like, man, but finish college, I have to go down this path. I just felt that wasn't right. And then I think the subsequent support from my family was huge. I mean, you know, having your parents say, all right, pivot from what you thought you were going to go mm-hmm. and, you know, find what you love. So it's a lot of things.
And then having the dream, like, I want to work at that restaurant in that kitchen, and being denied time and time and time again. And then finally saying, well, getting the yes.
Yep.
Like, what were you thinking when you kept applying?
I mean, it was at that time and still is, you know, one of the best restaurants in the city, if not state. And it was, you know, classic French. And, you know, I'd read a lot about Russell, and it was just, I knew that's where I wanted to be in St. Paul. And I knew that's where I wanted to work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just kept applying.
And then growing up, you grew up in, is it Apple Valley?
Apple Valley, yep.
All right, okay. People may not know this about you. You're also the culinary consultant for Allianz Field, where the soccer games are, the MLS Minnesota United. How did that come about?
You know, they reached out to me as the stadium was being constructed, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, where Allianz Field is located. I mean, it's dropped down in the middle of university in an extremely multicultural and diverse neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it was really important for them to celebrate the cultures and the neighborhood that it's in. Soccer is such an international sport, and University Avenue is such an international neighborhood. So they wanted somebody to help curate the food program in there to make sure that everybody was represented, appreciated, and that we really showed the true nature of soccer, which is a lot more than hot dogs and pretzels.
Right. I remember that announcer. I was happy to hear that. I'm like, yep, that's the right choice. And you also have a line of spices sold in grocery chains across the upper Midwest, as well as a signature whiskey blend with Tattersall. Dude, that's a lot.
Yes. That is the story of my life, a lot.
All right. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Chef Justin Sutherland, and we want to hear from you. Have you eaten at any of his restaurants? And if so, what are your favorite foods or drinks? Do you have a question for him about, you know, recipes or cooking? And have you seen him on some of those TV cooking competitions? Or you have questions? Do you like to watch the Food Channel, the Food Network? I do. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. All right, Justin, I know I speak for many people when I say I was really heartbroken when I learned about your boating accident on the 4th of July weekend. You were operating a boat with a group of your friends on board when your hat flew off into the water. Tell us what happened next.
You know, I made a gesture, kind of just reaching for the hat while it was in the air, and was off balance on my right foot, and then ended up going over. you know, I remember hitting the water, going in, and then as I went under, the boat just kind of drifted to where the propeller was directly above me. And as I was swimming up to the surface, I saw the propeller spinning. And then after that, kind of the lights went out and regained consciousness when I swam back, and I knew something was wrong. My friends jumped in, and it was pretty incredible.
Less than 3 months ago, tell us about the injuries you suffered.
I have a skull fracture on the right-hand side. I mean, the propeller sliced all the way through my face, so half my face was falling off when I got to the hospital. Didn't have a full vision in my left eye, compound fracture in my right arm, a lot of lacerations. It was pretty serious. I mean, most people don't understand why I'm alive today.
I look at you, and I don't see the scars. I don't see the physical injuries that you suffered. I mean, your doctors, and obviously you've done some work. You look really, really good. I want people to know that.
I appreciate that. And I credit a lot of that, and have to give a shout out to the team at Regents Hospital. They were absolutely amazing and helped me get back to where we are today. But there's definitely still a long road to go.
You've shared publicly about your mental health, and you and I have talked about this as well. How do you think this accident and this process of recovering from it has changed you?
Anything traumatic like this inevitably changes you. I mean, it makes you, you know, just evaluate all of the things in your life, and, you know, especially laying in a hospital bed for 16 days with, you know, just in pain with no, you know, connection with the outside world. You're stuck with yourself and your thoughts, and you really just, you know, it made me be really grateful for A, still being on this earth, and B, for, you know, for the things in my life, for the people in my life, for the love and support I got, and for where I'm at. So, you know, in the silver linings, when you get stuck with yourself, it kind of makes you stop and smell the roses and really be appreciative.
Mm-hmm. I think we've established that you're busy. You do a lot of things. You have a lot of gifts and talents. You like to be busy. I don't think I'm as talented as you, but I like to be busy as well.
I don't know about all that.
We were sharing the stories of each other's. I have a broken arm right now I'm recovering from. And I told you, I'm like, it was hard for me to sit and like not be able to move, like for a couple of weeks, not be able to work, and being alone with your thoughts sometimes, it's difficult. I don't know that I'm still enjoying like all the downtime I have right now because I go through physical therapy. But are you feeling that too? That it's hard to have conversations with yourself?
I don't so much not mind the conversations with myself. I think the biggest place I'm at right now is just that weird in-between stage. I mean, we've made so many strides from the hospital until now, and a lot of the physical things, like you said, I mean, do look miraculously better. But there's a lot of stuff inside that's just not better. And, you know, trying to balance that desire to get back out there, to get to work, to enjoy the things you used to in life, and then realizing that you're really not ready. You can't. And, you know, so that's a tough battle to deal with.
How are you doing looking at your scars?
I expected there to be a lot more considering. So, I actually don't mind them. I mean, you know, they kind of remind you of what you survived and to be, you know, grateful for what you have.
I read that you have not eaten solid food since that accident in July. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I mean, I'm up to soft foods now. I eat a lot of oatmeal, a lot of mashed potatoes.
Why can't you eat normal food?
There's 5 metal plates in the top of my face. I mean, every bone from my top upper row of teeth up was completely shattered. Both eye sockets, cheekbones, my entire upper top teeth. So that's all metal plates that's fused back together, and I can't put any pressure on my teeth. If I bite, I mean, it feels like glass is going to shatter if I bite my teeth down. I can't even chew a piece of gum. And that's going to be a while on that healing.
And so what is it like cooking? Have you been cooking again?
Honestly, not that really. Right now I've been tasting again. I found myself sucking on pieces of bacon or just licking food because I'm so sick of smoothies and protein shakes. And I just as a chef, keeping this flavor Bible that we keep in our head alive that I didn't want to lose. But I haven't been doing a lot of cooking. I could probably write a smoothie cookbook next because I've been making a lot of those.
Right. That could be helpful. Right. And I saw photos. It looks like you were able to take a vacation. Well, I think once you were able to travel again, was it helpful to get away from everything and have some time to, you know, reflect away from home?
Yes, I think that was absolutely important. Was just, you know, as soon as I was able, just to, you know, to get somewhere and get some peace and get away from all this for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take some phone calls, Justin. We're talking with Chef Justin Sutherland. He's the owner of the Handsome Hog. You may have been there in St. Paul, but also he has a new cookbook. His first cookbook. It's called Northern Soul: Southern Inspired Home Cooking from a Northern Kitchen, and you can get it now. It's out. If you want to give us a call, the number is 651 227-6000, or you can call 800-242-2828. Let's go to Minneapolis and talk to Susan, who's on the phone. Hey, Susan, what do you want to share or ask?
Yes, piggybacking on the chef's cookbook and love of soul food, I, along with two folks from the north side, had a magical experience at Crew Restaurant in St. Joseph, Minnesota, K-R-E-W-E.
I've been there.
Chef Mateo MacBee offers up recipes from his stays with his grandmother in the Deep South, and one of the folks that was in attendance is herself from the Deep South. So Chef came out and they had a little back and forth. We shared the jambalaya, the hush puppies, the most amazing bread pudding. And he and his he's the only black-owned business chef in Stearns County area, and along with Aaron Lucas, who is a co-owner, also runs Flower and Flower Bakery right next door.
And that's his wife, right?
Partner.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they're doing some amazing things with the farm, trying to bring produce to black-owned businesses on the north side, and also bringing youth from the urban area.
Susan, did you like the food? Did you enjoy the food you ate?
Oh, I love the food. I'm not from the Deep South, but I would go back in a heartbeat and go through the menu. And so it was just a wonderful, wonderful, unexpected experience. We were actually on our way to the pottery studios, but decided we wanted to wrap a lunch into the process. So,
all right, Susan, it sounds like we have you sold on soul food. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for calling. So, yes. So, do you know Chef Mateo MacBee there at Crew and just outside of
Absolutely. I've known Mateo for many, many years. And I remember when he, you know, decided to go open this restaurant up there, and everybody's like, you're moving where? to do what? And I think, you know, what his mission and what he's doing up there is just so important. I mean, A, being the only black-owned business in a county is huge. And what he's doing with the farming and you know, and with the youth and the food that he's making up there for – it's a cuisine that, you know, a lot of people in Stearns County probably have never had or never would be exposed to. So I think it's incredible what they're doing up there.
Yeah, it's a New Orleans inspired, and it's Crew, K-R-E-W-E.
Yep.
And so hearing Susan talk about, like, oh, I like this food. do you hear that when folks, particularly when they come to Handsome Hog in St. Paul, like, I didn't think this was not part of my upbringing, but this is pretty good. Do you get that feedback a lot?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people have never had collard greens. And like, you know, and then they have them like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And
like spinach.
Exactly.
It's not like spinach. All right. Let's take another phone call. We have in Sioux Falls, Sherry on the phone. Good morning, Sherry. What did you want to share with us as we talk with Chef Justin Sutherland?
Good morning. I am a lawyer by training and probably wish I had been a chef, but I'm a home cook like crazy. Write cookbooks for my kids as friends when they graduate from high school, that kind of a thing. And I had a near-death experience a year ago that resulted in me being on a feeding tube for 5 weeks and could not eat or drink a drop of water for 5 weeks.
Mm. Yeah,
and as a cook, I mean, I empathize completely. I couldn't even lick the bacon, which is really a drag. I couldn't do any of that. And what I mean, people are always telling me, aren't you lucky you're alive, which is absolutely 100% true. But I wonder what you do to manage the reality with mental health about how many things we lose when this happens. Like, I can't wear my favorite perfume because I'm afraid I'll get a wave of nausea and I'll never be able to smell it again without being sick. So little day-to-day things like that. And yes, of course, I'm grateful I'm alive, but I don't, sometimes I struggle with, what about all the other stuff, you know, that I went through that where it's, I don't want to get drowning in the negative, but I also want to give it its fair credit.
Right. And Sherry, again, this accident was a year ago for you?
It was a surgery that they went in to fix one thing and they found I had abscesses in my stomach and holes in my esophagus. And so I went in for a same day surgery and ended up on a feeding tube and in the hospital and completely unexpected. Lucky I'm not dead. Again, same thing that the chef has heard too. And I am very lucky that I'm not dead.
All right. Thank you, Cher. I'm glad that you're doing better. Is it difficult to hear people share their stories like that with you, Justin?
You know, a lot of times it helps, you know, and that's why I, you know, made that Facebook post to be able to, you know, kind of help, you know, whoever's out there that's going through the same things. But, you know, it's a journey. It's the accident and the recovery is a journey. And then the getting back to normal or realizing that you're never going to fully be back to normal is definitely a journey. I mean, some days, you know, you're just ecstatic when you can't feel, you know, forget about how lucky you are to be alive. And again, the next day you find yourself in tears because you can't pick up a saute pan with your left arm anymore. So it's I think, you know, it's the beginning of that journey for me. So, you know, I don't know, but I know it's definitely a process.
Mm-hmm. Cher, thank you for calling. And yeah, you did write about some days, you know, you have survivor's guilt and recognizing physically you may look the same, but you know that you're not.
Yeah.
Justin, I love watching the Food Network and some of the other channels, too, that have the competitions on. What do you make of the popularity of these programs, you know, before you were a contestant and now after? I mean, why do you think people like to watch them?
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, food's exciting. Food's is an international language that brings everybody together. And, you know, I think getting just that glimpse into that kind of chef life that was always kind of mysterious, hidden back in the kitchen. And you know, and then seeing some of your favorite chefs from your favorite restaurants run around a grocery store and, yeah, you know, create food on the fly. I mean, it just brings a smile to your face. It's easy fun.
It's high drama and it's the clock that always gets right. Me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I have 5 seconds. Get the sauce on there. Is that real?
That clock is absolutely real. I mean, yes. I think Iron Chef is the one more than anything. I mean, that 5 dishes in 1 hour is the most insane thing ever. And, you know, you walk in there and they say, you ready? I was like, we're starting now. And then the next thing I know, the clock's ticking and we're running around and I literally blacked out. I don't even remember what happened. I mean, I just started going. I think you just go into this survival mode and just cook.
And where are the cameras? Are they above you, kind of like just everywhere?
No, they're everywhere. I mean, there's live camera people following you around. I mean, other than the chefs, there's probably, you know, 10 cameras walking around, the whole thing surrounded, cameras above.
Yeah, it's wild. You won an Iron Chef episode a few years ago, and you competed on season 16 of Top Chef. And right now, you're one of the chefs featured on Fast Foodies, and you're also now working as a producer and a host of Taste the Culture, which airs on True TV and TBS. So what are you doing as a producer and host, and what is Taste the Culture?
Yeah, Taste the Culture's a new project that I got to help create and, like you said, be the producer on. But, you know, it's an opportunity to kind of take the spotlight off me. We travel around the country, and we focus on BIPOC-owned, immigrant-owned, women-owned businesses in the food space, everything from distilleries to restaurants to farms to coffee makers, and just finding there's just so many amazing stories out there that nobody would ever know about, you know. So I get to go celebrate these amazing people.
And we can watch that here? Do you know what time size? Is it on different days and nights?
It's on different days and nights. And you can stream all the episodes are on YouTube. It's on Delta Airlines if you're flying, and HBO Max, and then it'll on the Turner Networks, okay. True TV, TBS, TNT. But you can stream them all on YouTube. And season 2 comes out here in a couple weeks.
Excellent. It's called Taste the Culture. Now, when you were a contestant on Iron Chef, was it hard keeping the final episode a secret? Because you couldn't reveal whether or not you'd won it all until a few weeks later, like after the episode aired. What was that like?
Yeah, it was months later. I mean, they make an episode, and, you know, there's, you know, sometimes 4 to 5 months of editing. So keeping that quiet for 6 months, especially knowing that I had won, was a lot.
And what does that do for a chef? I mean, when you win, you know, an episode of Chopped or Top Chef, like, can it boost your career? Does it make a big difference?
I would say generally it does. I mean, always what it does is definitely give you an opportunity. And I think it's what you do with that opportunity afterwards that, you know, that's different.
All right. Let's take more phone calls as we talk with Twin City chef Justin Sutherland, the author of a new cookbook called Northern Soul, Southern Inspired Home Cooking from a Northern Kitchen. Let's go to Bemidji, where Jill is on the phone. Good morning, Jill. What's your question or what did you want to share?
Hi, I'm Jill from Bemidji, Minnesota area. And hi, Justin.
Hi.
So I have a kind of a techie question. So we have a vegetable farm here that we raise, you know, just a spectrum of vegetables. And we do farmers markets in Walker and Bemidji, as well as sell to Harmony, the co-op in Bemidji. And I myself have always been interested in cooking directly from the garden, freezing and preserving, canning all my vegetables so that I don't have to buy from the grocery store. It's like a competition with myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on trying to produce low gluten products like breads, desserts, things like that. And I'd like to find a binding agent that's natural, like an applesauce or, you know, flax or chia. And I wondered if you had, you know, any ideas on using that instead of using a, you know, a wheat.
You know, those were actually three of the things that I was going to recommend, was the, especially the applesauce and chia I've used. What was the question?
Like, well, then, yeah, so like, I try to buy local as well, so yep. I went to rent in Natural Way Mills in Middle River, which I've bought stuff there for the last 25 years, and I grabbed some brown rice flour, some flour, and a spelt. And I've cooked on and off of those before, but I'm getting a lot more serious now because my own digestive issues, you know, I need to take a look at that. And so I've used applesauce in the past, but I'm just kind of playing around. If you think the chia or the flax ground, you know, in both cases, if those are as effective, or, you know, what's been your experience with that?
I don't know as effective, but one other thing I was going to recommend is chickpea flour works great. But okay. the chia works really nice. And if you bloom them first, you know, so they so they open up, and then use that, and it's already kind of gotten that gelatinous coating on it. That's really, once you bake, is going to kind of settle in and help bind that together and actually keep it very, very moist.
I want to mention there's a chapter in the cookbook called Pickled Things, and you pickling all kinds of things. Can you tell people about this, about not just cucumbers? You have the spicy cucumber pickles, but what else are you pickling?
I mean, everything. We've got pickled pears, peaches, strawberries, pickled watermelon rind, green tomatoes, okra. You know, that's just a big part of southern cooking is, mm-hmm. you know, you have these short seasons, and being able to enjoy these vegetables year round. I think pickling is a huge part of it.
And you show us how to do it. My favorite dish at Handsome Hog is the chicken and waffles, because it's got the pickled pears mm-hmm. on top of it. Let's take another phone call as we talk with Chef Justin Sutherland in St. Paul. We have Nate on the phone. Good morning, Nate. What did you want to share or ask?
First of all, good morning. So I am super happy to be on this call. I am not from Minnesota. I am a transplant from New York. I just moved here in January, and I had an opportunity to go to your restaurant, and it was the best restaurant that I've been to in St. Paul.
Are you talking about Handsome Hog?
In all of Minnesota. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I had an opportunity to go with a bunch of friends of mine who pressed the issue, and I actually ended up going to the old restaurant that you used to have. Because Google didn't have it mapped out right. So it was a scavenger hunt.
The old location?
Really,
Lowertown.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You went to the old location. Okay. And so now they're in the new. And yep. Tell folks again, it's on Selby Avenue.
Yep. Handsome Selby Hog. And Western.
Okay. Go ahead, Nate. Mm-hmm.
So I left Big Tech to come to Minnesota to really do some work for inner city youth and the Twin Cities. And I get a lot of kids who I am trying to change their trajectory and their start. A lot of kids that I have are very interested in cooking, right? Mm-hmm. Because they talk about the passion and the love that it takes to be a part of that. I was wondering, what opportunities do you have or provide for internships or for mentorship programs that I can set these kids up with? Because to have somebody that looks like them and that cooks as great as you out in the world of not their mom's house is very important and impactful. So I'm just looking for an opportunity to figure out how we can connect and create that pipeline.
That connection. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Nate, and welcome to Minnesota. Justin, before you answer that, I just want people to know, I mean, you've earned a lot of respect for your involvement in community events and fundraisers for charitable causes, philanthropy during the pandemic. You know, I bumped into you before the pandemic. We were at a fundraiser for Cookie Cart, and mm-hmm. you were one of the guest chefs. So you clearly have a connection and care about giving back. But when Nate talks about kids wanting to cook, what have you seen with young people and what an experience in the kitchen can do for them?
I think that experience is incredible. And working with youth, especially underserved and inner city youth, is something that's extremely, extremely important to me. We actually have a foundation called the Leadership Garden where we do the same and try and just expose kids to things that they would have never, you know, never been exposed to before.
I haven't heard about Leadership Guard. What is that, and what happens?
Yes, yeah, so we work with an organization in North Minneapolis called the Inner City Ducks, and that what they do is provide after school sports, football, basketball in these school systems that can't afford to to have those programs. So, you know, so we provide those for them, along with mentorship and, you know, job skills and just human skills. And, you know, we went started with the ducks, and now the ducks are underneath our leadership garden, to where, well, like what he was saying, I mean, we took a group of kids to the Target Center, and rather than going to watch the basketball game, you know, going and taking them back through the back offices and all of the things that it takes to produce a basketball game, because, you know, these kids love sports, and most of you are not going to make it in the NBA, but if you want to work in this industry, here are a lot of the other opportunities that you could go down to be close to your favorite sport and also turn that into a job.
During the pandemic, you made news because you were part of a, you know, an effort to support hospitality workers. Tell me about co-founding North Stands, what that did and why you wanted to be a part of that.
Yeah. My good friend, Chef David Fema, and I, you know, it's just this pandemic happened, and, you know, everything changed in our life, and it changed, you know, it affected everybody, but the hospitality industry, especially, I mean, it's an industry where a lot of people don't have, you know, health insurance, where they're living paycheck to paycheck, where, you know, their jobs are based fully on tips. And it was just so difficult to watch that happen. So we wanted to just, you know, it was kind of just a no questions asked situation. We went out and fundraised and raised money, and people could go on the website, you know, say where they worked, what their hospitality connection was, and we just mailed them a check. We just wanted people to just to get through.
And I remember in March of 2020, I remember watching the local TV news when the pandemic first happened and everything got closed.
Yep.
You were out there clearing out your freezers and refrigerators and giving away your groceries just to people who needed food, right? Because you weren't able to cook with it.
Right. You know, on that first day, we were like, all right, everybody thought, this is just going to be a week or so. We're going to shut down. And after, you know, the first couple of days, when we realized this is going to be a long thing, I knew that I had, and just about every other restaurant was going to have pantries full of produce and food that they couldn't sell that was going to go bad. And so we just wanted to give it away. So, you know, between chefs like Brian Ingram and JD Fratsky and Jametta Raspberry and David Fema, and, you know, I just called all my chef buddies and I said, my food's going bad. I bet yours is too. I was like, bring it down to Public Kitchen. And we literally cleared the tables out and turned it into a free pantry. And we announced it, and it was unbelievable. I mean, it was amazing to be able to do it, but it was also just heartbreaking. I mean, the line was wrapped around for blocks and blocks, people lining up at 5 a.m. in the middle of March when it's freezing. And you go down this line and you're seeing, you know, your favorite bartender from the restaurant you were just at a week ago. You're seeing these managers of restaurants and people, and just realizing that food insecurity was going to be real. So this was just going to be a short time, one time thing to get rid of the food in our coolers. And then we were like, no, we have to keep doing this, you know. So we reached out to larger corporations, you know, U.S. Foods and Cisco's, and started taking community donations. And, you know, then Brian Ingram opened up his every Tuesday, you know, free market down at the Nome down the street. And we just, you know, kept feeding people, because that's all we really know how to do. We're chefs. We feed people. And
tell me about Chef Buddies. So is there a brotherhood, sisterhood among a lot of the chefs here in Minnesota? You know each other, and there's, I'm sure, some competition, but it sounds like you guys, many of you are close.
Yeah, I think Minnesota has such an amazing hospitality and culinary scene, and especially in the chef world. You know, there's always a little friendly competition, but it's really not. I mean, you know, we all do better when we all do better. And I want to open my restaurant next to the best restaurant in town, you know, and just, I think we feed off each other. And this pandemic, I think, really, really helped bring people, you know, bring everybody together in that chef community, because we weren't allowed to do what we do anymore. We feed people, and that was taken away from us. So figuring out how to continue, you know, giving and feeding and sharing with the world really, really helped bring people together.
I'm talking with Chef Justin Sutherland and taking your phone calls in Minneapolis. Let's talk to John. John, thank you for holding, and what do you want to ask or share?
Hi, Chef Angela.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm thinking about switching jobs and careers to get into cooking. My question for the chef, I do not have a formal culinary degree. Is this a pipe dream?
No, and in fact, I mean, especially, you know, not to knock any of the culinary schools out there, but, you know, in my opinion, and I think a lot of chefs would share the same, if it's something you're passionate about, you know, find a chef or a restaurant in town. Most would be willing to, you know, take you under their wing, you know, per se, and have you come in and just work. You know, it's like instead of paying for an education, you can come work for free somewhere and just do the stage type internship and just, you know, find somebody who's willing to work with you. And I think you'll gain way more practical experience that way than sitting in a classroom.
So
thank you. And one more thing, Chef. I learned from my grandmother and my mother, Italian mother, and my father, who would always say, come here and learn. Come to the stove and learn. And that's how I learned. So I don't know what I would put on my resume that I learned from my Italian mother. I mean,
cooking is such a practical, hands-on skill that I can't tell you the last time I've ever looked at somebody's resume when they come in and apply for a job. It's, can you do this or not? You can write whatever you want on a piece of paper. And I think that the skills that you did learn from your grandparents are extremely important, but the ability to demonstrate those are what people are looking for. So I think if you approached a chef or a restaurant with the passion that you have right now, saying that you're really there just to learn, you're probably going to peel potatoes for a while, but just being in that environment and watching and absorbing everything is going to be the best path for you.
Thank you. And, Justin, it's one thing to be an executive chef. It's another thing to be a restaurant owner or operator. Why did you want to become an owner? Like, why did you want to jump into the business side of it?
You know, the business side of it, I mean, like I said, I went to school for business management. I've always just had an acumen for that. And honestly, you can only stand on a line for so long. I mean, it's a trying job. One day you're like, my knees and my feet hurt. I don't know how much. But I also stubbornly, I got to this point where I didn't think I was going to be able, I don't know how much longer I was going to be able to work for somebody else. And I still wanted to be in this industry. And it's kind of just that leap of, let's try and do some stuff on your own.
Talk to me about, you've had successes and, well, I guess successes and failures, because I'm trying to keep the list. Now, wait a minute, you were at Public Kitchen, but no, then that closed. And so what is going on when a place closes or when you make the decision, like, this is not going to work, I need to switch to something else? What's going on there with the thought process of some place that was hot, but now it's not, so now we got to do something else?
It's tough, and the pandemic is one of the biggest factors. I mean, that shut a lot of restaurants down, and then when we could reopen, really evaluating, are you still passionate about this restaurant? Was it doing well? Could it be something different? So, it allowed you to evaluate and make some critical decisions. And I think especially, restaurants and food as chefs, I mean, that's our art, and that's something you're passionate about. And, to have to close something down like that, you got to be smart, though, and you got to say, does this make business sense anymore? Is this just something I'm throwing money into because I feel good about it?
And then how do you know where to go? Like location. For example, Handsome Hog used to be in Lower Town. Mm-hmm. Now it's on Selby and Western. Would that be considered like Cathedral Hill
area, yep.
What's the difference? Like how important is location?
Location's huge, and the move for Handsome Hog was location-driven and necessary. When restaurants were able to reopen, we're at 50% capacity. You could, mostly or only eat outside. And in Lower Town, we had 66 seats and a tiny patio. Mm-hmm. And just running the numbers, there was no way we would be able to serve enough people to pay our bills. So the move up to Cathedral Hill got us up to almost 300 seats. We have a 120-seat patio. So even at that 50% capacity, we could still get enough people inside. And that patio space is what absolutely saved our life.
It saved my life a couple of times, a couple of nights. I have to tell people that outdoor patio space at Handsome Hog along Selby there, you had the fire pits, you had an ice bar, even when the winter was cold, the warmers, the heaters, and it was still a gathering space for people, which was lovely, right? Because we needed to be together.
Yep.
And that was a gift to a lot of people.
We'll be doing that again this year. So.
Okay. And then the smoke, where was smoke coming from? Smoke in the meats?
It was, what's that?
The smoke. Was it from the fire or was it from you guys?
Probably mostly from the fires.
From the fires, right? Because it smelled good. I had this image of it, and it was a fun time. Let's take another phone call. In St. Paul, John is on the line. Hi, John. What did you want to ask or share with Chef Justin Sutherland?
Well, first of all, Justin, congratulations on your comeback. It's awesome. Angela, I've heard you do your show here. I just want to congratulate on how you've improved. You're asking really good, nuanced questions, and congratulations to both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, my simple question, Justin, it's been pretty well documented how your friends got together and helped your recovery. Just kind of interested in hearing your thoughts on how your understanding of friendship has deepened.
You know, it is deepened to levels I still haven't even fully realized. I think you go through life and you have friends and you interact with these people and, you know, a situation comes up like this and the outpouring of love and support that came from my close friends to complete strangers. You know, I think you really realize the impact that you do have on other people's lives. I think everybody. I mean, you know, from the one time you were nice to that person, the smile that you gave somebody, and just all of those little moments that kind of built up, you know, and that everybody wanted to help you in your time of need. So, my respect and love and for everybody and the friendships has definitely deepened.
Justin, you want to talk about an event this coming weekend on Sunday. What is happening on Sunday you want people to know about?
Yeah, we actually have two amazing events coming up the next couple Sundays. But this Sunday at Allianz Field, we have our Smokeout Festival. It's a big barbecue, drinks, and music festival outdoors on the front lawn. About 20 different restaurants and barbecues will be setting up their smokers. You get in, it's all-you-can-eat barbecue. We'll have amazing music like Nerd D and Alex Rossi and DJ D Mill, Prize Brewing, all kinds of specialty cocktails. So that is this Sunday, the 3rd, from 12 to 6 at Allianz Field.
And who is we when you say we? Allianz Field?
What's that? I partner with Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine to put that on. So that's okay. Where you can go to get tickets, MinneapolisStPaulMagazine.com/smokeout.
And then what else do you want folks to know about?
Yeah, we're doing, you know, after all the support that the restaurant industry showed me during this, we're doing what we're calling our Black and Blue Ball, which is a foundation set up by Craft Made Aprons, my good friend Kate Meyer. But we are raising money for hospitality workers that, you know, that may be uninsured or having physical pain, mental health issues, financial struggles. And this is literally a fund that we will keep that anybody in that industry that needs help can get into. So on October 16th at the Radisson Blue at the Mall of America, we're bringing in chefs from around the country, a lot of your favorite top chefs, Joe Sasto, Brian Young, and we're going to do a 7-course dinner, auction, cocktail hour, live music. So this will be at the Radisson Blue on October 16th. You can go on the Craft Made Aprons page and get tickets for the Black and Blue Ball.
And is that new, the Black and Blue? Or
no, Project Black and Blue has been around for a few years, actually. I mean, Kate helped a lot of people during the pandemic with that as just, you know, extra funds to help get through. But now it's just become so important to me after my accident and you know, all of the help that people showed. And I just want to make sure that, you know, when other people are in the same situation that I was in, that they have the resources and funds to pay their bills and to get through.
As you look ahead to the winter months, how are you going to spend some of your free time? What do you think? What do you think will be new and next for you?
New and next, you know, it's, I'm just still, you know, in that recovery path and figuring out what is actually going to be next. You know, my goal is just to day by day try and get back into what my regular life was. I mean, with the restaurants here at home and, you know, I had 3 TV projects we were in the process of filming or about to start that got put on hold. So trying to get those back on the calendar. But also, you know, still taking it slow and making sure that I'm fully ready to get back to it.
Well, it's been a delight to talk with you. I love this cookbook. I hope you'll sign it for me. Again, Chef Justin Sutherland's cookbook is called Northern Soul, Southern-Inspired Home Cooking from a Northern Kitchen. Some beautiful photos inside of Justin's family and him doing some cooking and with his friends. It's been a gift to talk with you and to know you, Justin. The conversation today was produced by Maya Beckstrom. Be safe, everyone. We'll talk to you again tomorrow morning at 9. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder that if you want to catch my show in real time, tune in and call in weekdays at 9 a.m.